I'm excited to talk to you about women's health, and I'm here from the University of Colorado Center for Women's Health Research, where one key part of our three-part mission are events just like these, to do community education and outreach of the lay public and of health providers to try to improve women's health through education. So this is fabulous. It's part of our mission. The other two parts of our mission are to do cutting-edge research in women's health and to train the next generation of women's health researchers, and I'll tell you more about that as we go. Okay, so since this is meant to be a 101 course, I thought I would try to give us some objectives so you know what we're trying to get through with our curriculum and keep it pretty simple, but yet cover some breadth. So we're gonna define what is women's health. I'm gonna try to give you a simple conceptual framework for women's health so you can think about it in a few different ways, a few facets. And we'll talk about why women's health is important. You probably wouldn't be here today if you didn't think it was, but this way you can convince some other people as well. We're going to talk about some current high priority women's health areas and go through our lifespan approach to women's health that we try to take at the Center for Women's Health Research so we can kind of show you how women's health is important across the lifespan. And finally, at the end, I'll try to make it personal and let you think about what women's health can do for you, what resources there are for you if you're interested in aspects of your health, and also what you could do for women's health. So we'll take that both ways. So first of all, definitions. So I put three different definitions of women's health up here, which I'll just read to you, so you can reflect that they're actually fairly different. There's maybe some different ideas out there about what women's health really is. So one from the World Health Organization is that being a man or a woman has a significant impact on health as a result of both biological and gender-related differences. So that gives us the idea that there's sex differences, that women's health and men's health is important. We want to think about what's distinct about each gender. The health of women and girls is of particular concern because in many societies they are disadvantaged by discrimination rooted in sociocultural factors. So that's from the WHO. The Medical Dictionary Online says women's health is the effect of gender on disease and health that encompasses a broad range of biological and psychosocial issues. So again, there we see recapitulated there's biology, and then there's also sociocultural or societal factors. And then Wikipedia says women's health refers to health issues specific to human female anatomy or to conditions caused by hormones specific to or most notable in females. They can also include medical situations in which women face problems not directly related to their biology. For example, gender-differentiated access to medical treatment. And that's, I think, the first statement in there about some biases that might exist in our healthcare systems, which is actually another important thing to consider. So I'm gonna try to go through a fairly simple way to think about women's health as a conceptual framework. So, women's health includes variations by sex in the following types of factors. Frequency, how commonly a condition or disease presents. Certain things only happen in women, ovarian cancer, pregnancy, and yet these things, especially pregnancy and the effects of the intrauterine environment, have an impact on all people, men and women, as they age. So there's some things about women's health that relate to frequency. Presentation, how a disease presents. Some people may have heard descriptions of typical chest pain or how heart attacks might present have been really derived mainly from symptoms in males because we weren't really studying women at the time that we developed the description of what these typical symptoms were. So crushing, substernal chest pain with shortness of breath, nausea, those types of symptoms are described as typical heart attack symptoms, whereas women often present with what are described as atypical symptoms. Maybe just some burning pain. I had a patient who had a heart attack with just a burning pain in her left arm. That was her symptom of her heart attack. So there can be differences in presentations of diseases, and that's part of women's health as well. Severity. I said how deadly a disease is, but also how morbid it is, or how severe it is in its consequences. Not necessarily just does it kill you, but how difficult does it make your life? So the severity of diseases also can vary in women and men, even for the same disease, and that's another important factor. Finally, treatment. How effective certain treatments are and how that may vary by sex, and we've seen that certain treatments are more effective in men than in women, and then perhaps vice versa as well. So that's one piece of it. And then, or how commonly appropriate treatments are used, and I'm gonna recapitulate with that some of that potential gender bias of how healthcare providers might anticipate certain diseases a little more commonly in men than in women, and how that could be an important thing in terms of women's health. Okay, so why is women's health research important? So as I sort of said briefly as I was talking about those differences in presentation of heart attack symptoms, women's health issues have been historically understudied, and part of that is because it was felt that women were a little more difficult to study than men. They have menstrual cycles. They don't have the same levels of hormones at all points in time. So you might have to bring them in at certain days and not others. So these things made it more difficult for researchers to study women. So for quite some time, they just didn't. That may seem like a shock. And in fact, only this year did the NIH, just a couple of months ago, the National Institutes of Health, mandate that researchers who apply for grants from the NIH must state if there's a reason they're not planning to enroll the equal numbers of women and men into their studies. And beyond that, if they're doing animal studies with rats or mice, they must include both male and female rodents. This was not the case. And especially in the basic science research, most studies are done with male lab animals. So this is really quite new that we're studying women on par with men, and it's really just starting to break open with these new mandates. So for those reasons, we have more questions than answers in areas of women's health and in many areas of health that have been traditionally studied with men. And we want to close the deadly knowledge gap that exists in women's health research so that healthcare providers can better diagnose and treat diseases in women, and women can lead longer, healthier, and more productive lives. So I wanted to give some examples of sex differences. I've defined it, I've given you a conceptual framework. So on this slide, just to orient you to it, so you can see that we've got the United States, and then on the left are the changes in male mortality rates from the 1990s to the mid-2000s. And then on the right, we have the changes in female mortality rates. And the graph, the blue is a substantial improvement for royal blue. The green-blue is minimal improvement. And then the red is worsening. So you can see that mortality rates for women on the right, there's a lot more red there than there is on the left. So we're seeing worsening death rates in women from the 1990s to the mid-2000s. This was a report done by the Institute of Medicine on the state of health really over all of the United States, but it included comments on women's health. So the report was titled Shorter Lives and Poorer Health. That's not very optimistic. And it went into some details about how we're very wealthy as a nation, but not particularly healthy compared to other well-developed nations. That these outcomes are not just restricted to those of lower socioeconomic status, but are actually true across many different racial and socioeconomic strata. And that I'll highlight here, women are hardest hit by a substantial margin, and especially by non-communicable, just means not infectious, really. So if we're thinking of diseases that are not infectious, among those cardiovascular diseases. So US men aren't doing all that great compared to European men either. Their heart attack risk is 34% higher, which is substantial. But if we look at the heart attack risk for US women as compared to European women, it's 159% higher, so 1.5 times greater. Quite a big difference there between the risk for women in the US as compared to their European counterparts and the male differences. The other things that were a big issue for women that I'm not gonna spend as much time on today in this talk, but that are important to know, include unintentional injuries such as accidental drug overdose, and that's certainly been a rising problem in the United States in the last decades. And then infant mortality rate is also a major problem, especially in minority women. So I thought I would try to dig a little deeper into one topic in this talk so that you could get a little depth. And then I've also hopefully given you some breadth, and I'll end at the end with a little more breadth as well. But I'm going to spend a little bit of time on women and heart disease to go into some of the rationale for why there may be sex differences in this. We just said that there were, you know, that women were the hardest hit and cardiovascular disease was one of the main issues. So let's dig into that a little bit. So in the United States, cardiovascular disease is the leading cause of death in women. More women in the United States die of heart disease than men. Not just do we die the most of heart disease, but if we compare that to the next seven causes combined, it's still greater. So heart disease is a major problem for women. Here we have a graph that just shows the leading causes of death for all men and women in the United States in the year 2000. And in the red, we have males. The white bars are females. And then the letters that we're describing, A is total cardiovascular disease. So CVD stands for cardiovascular disease, including heart attacks, strokes, things of that like. And you can see this is just bearing out those statistics I just told you. So 505,000 plus women and 440,000 plus men. And then we can compare the cancer deaths are actually slightly greater in males than in females. Accidents, fairly similar. Chronic lower respiratory diseases, that's D. And then E is diabetes mellitus. So I've only included some of those on the slide, but you can see that the key point is I've just given you statistics to go with the statement I gave on the prior slide. And then here's the trending, which is not good either. So we've kept males in red on this graph, and we've kept females in white. And we're showing the rates of death from cardiovascular disease from 1979 to 2000. And you can see a somewhat steady decline in males in the rates of death from cardiovascular disease, whereas with women, it's either flat or perhaps slightly worsening. So it raises a question, why are deaths from heart disease declining in men but not in women? So we could consider this as two potential broad reasons. One would be a perceptual problem of clinicians and even lay people, perhaps, in terms of what symptoms might lead them to go to the doctor for heart disease. And then a second problem would be biological. And this is, again, in keeping with our overall description of women's health, that there's biological factors and then there's also sociocultural factors or perceptions. So in terms of the perceptual problems, these are some sad truths. So if we look at all women with heart disease, coronary artery disease, which means they've either had a stent placed for a blocked coronary artery or had a heart attack, and heart failure, which means that they've had some loss of muscle in their heart from a heart attack, and they're not squeezing quite as well as someone with a normal heart would do. So women with those conditions as compared to men with those same conditions would be less likely to be managed by a cardiologist and more likely to be treated by a general practitioner. And just so you know, I'm a general practitioner, I'm a general internist, so I give no disrespect to managing complex patients by primary care doctors, but patients like this are very complicated, and it's possible we would certainly want a specialist, a cardiologist, to be managing them. Those women would be less likely to get appropriate diagnostic tests to evaluate their symptoms, such as coronary angiography to look for blocked arteries, exercise stress testing to see if there are any arteries that are not perfusing the heart appropriately that are fairly clogged. Less likely to be treated with medications that have been proven beneficial for these conditions. So here's where we get into some concerns about how are we functioning as a healthcare system. Why might we be giving differential evidence-based treatment by gender? And women experience less improvement 1 year after hospital admission for heart failure than men. So these are some, we think, perceptual problems rather than biological differences. More perceptual problems. So you now, from this talk, know more than perhaps 90% of primary care physicians about how heart disease acts on women versus men, that it's a greater killer for women versus men. And this is, again, why part of our mission as a center for women's health research is to educate both providers and the lay public. And so here's an example of how we might be biased in our evaluation of patients. So a clinical scenario was presented to primary care physicians, and they gave them, you know, a description of someone with some chest pain, with exertion, and some other symptoms that would be suggestive of possibly a cardiac condition. With no gender reference, half of the physicians felt that a cardiac diagnosis was likely. When they said this is a woman with these symptoms, or this is a man with these symptoms, then 60% of the male patients, the doctors thought that a cardiac diagnosis was likely. If the providers were hearing these symptoms about a female patient, only 30% of them thought that a cardiac diagnosis was likely. And then if they said that the patient was stressed, the number of male patients was still similar, but we became a little more dismissive of the female patients and felt that only 15% of those patients would have a cardiac diagnosis. So this is another issue with a perceptual problem. Biological factors. So I'm not trying to be too glib, but a woman is not a small man. My pediatrician colleagues like to say this too, that kids are not just small adults. That heart disease is different in women than in men. I didn't want to go through an exhaustive number of statistics, some of which are a little more technical, but compared to men, women have smaller hearts, just the mass of the hearts are smaller, and that makes sense since body habitus of women is usually smaller than men. Similarly, the coronary arteries, and again, this is probably a scaling phenomenon, are smaller. So we have smaller arteries, smaller hearts, and then the muscle fibers of the heart are also smaller. So there's some biological factors here that could be different and could explain part of why women do more poorly after heart attacks in terms of their survival rate than men. So how can we improve women's health? I've painted perhaps not the most bright picture so far, so I'll look to improve that as we go. So we're going to revisit the conceptual framework I told you about earlier. There's the frequency of how commonly things occur. There's the presentation of how diseases present and being mindful both as patients and as healthcare providers as to how your symptoms might be different if you're a man or a woman. The severity of a disease and then the treatments. So if we want to improve women's health, to target the perceptions of disease, how people recognize presentations of disease, we want to educate people. That's something that's going to be helpful, is to educate people as to, you know, this is how a disease might present in a woman versus a man. We need to target our biological differences through research. We need to understand when treatments are better for men versus women and vice versa. We need to understand in terms of prevention, if things are happening more commonly in men versus women, if they're associated with certain factors, we need to know how to target that. So research is helpful to us in that regard. So this is the approach that we take at the University of Colorado Center for Women's Health Research, is we try to work with scientists together in disciplines, and we have currently 30 junior scientists and then several senior scientists who are helping to mentor these scientists so that we have a critical mass of people working on a specific topic to try to tackle these different angles that we need to do to understand a topic well. These scientists are able to work across disciplines in a synergistic, strategic, cost-effective way to accelerate research, speed the transfer of new knowledge to improve the diagnosis and treatment of diseases in women. And I mentioned earlier our three-part mission. This is actually unique for us as a Center for Women's Health Research across the country, that we have such a strong focus on education and outreach, as well as mentoring and training the next generation, in addition to conducting cutting-edge research. So here I've just displayed that three-part mission there boldly for you, that the research piece is to carry out this groundbreaking research. And we have a specific focus area on cardiovascular disease in women, which is also somewhat unique amongst other centers across the country. Many other centers focus more on diseases that are very relevant to women's biology being different than men, like breast cancer or ovarian cancer, reproductive diseases. So this is something that's a unique focus for us. We want to know about sex differences in these areas. We care about men, too. We want to know when treatments need to be differentiated by gender. Mentoring, I described to you, in education. So this is our across the lifespan approach to women's health that we take. And we have a key goal to try to preempt lifelong diseases that begin during pregnancy and the early developmental stages. You remember I said earlier that pregnancy is an important time where the intrauterine environment may have a lot of impacts on women and men's health down the road. And I have just a few of those things listed here. Preterm birth, IUGR stands for intrauterine growth restriction, and is when the placenta is not giving as much nutrients to the baby as it needs, and that leads to a lot of stress. Macrosomia is when you have big babies, large babies, and that happens often with gestational diabetes. And I'll show a slide in a moment about gestational diabetes effects on health for men and women based on having a mother with gestational diabetes or not. So I'm not going to go into the other details, but this is one key focus for us is to, we say, what happens in the womb doesn't stay in the womb. So we want to try to protect people from those consequences and prevent these diseases in pregnant women. And also, when we can't prevent them, learn how to best treat babies who are born to women who have these conditions during pregnancy. And then you'll see that there's effects then in the pregnant mother on both the fetus, the neonate, the infant, and that those effects can carry on, as I said, into later life. And in addition, we seek to prevent the disease burden and reduce costs of diseases lifelong. And I mentioned we have a key focus on diabetes and cardiovascular disease. And I was introduced as I was going to talk to you more about exercise, but I thought I would try to stick to more of a broad survey of women's health topics today. So I love to talk about exercise, but I didn't get into it in great detail today. So here's the slide I promised you. So this is showing the late effects of the intrauterine environment, or what starts in the womb doesn't stay in the womb. What you're looking at along the y-axis is the percentage of young adults aged 20 to 24 who have developed diabetes. So this would be type 2 diabetes, or what we used to call adult onset diabetes, but now it's been developing people even in their teenage years and in their early 20s, where it was fairly unheard of in many past decades. In the last 20 to 30 years, this has been happening more and more. And part of that is what I'm going to show here on the different bars. So if you were born to a mother who did not have diabetes, your likelihood, your rate of diabetes in your early 20s is 1.4%. It's fairly low. If you had a pre-diabetic mother, that's a mother who during pregnancy, she didn't develop full gestational diabetes, but her sugars rose into a more borderline range where they were higher than normal, but not fully qualifying as diabetes. And so someone whose mother had that condition would have an 8.6% chance of diabetes in their 20s. Now, if your mother had gestational diabetes, it's risen up to 45.5% in your early 20s. So you can see that I wasn't lying to you about what starts in the womb doesn't stay in the womb. There are these effects that persist. And there's a description of this that's been called fetal programming. And what it really means is we think that your genetics didn't change because you still have your genes from your mother and your genes from your father. But those genes, in terms of how they're coded and how they're expressed, were affected by the intrauterine environment to sort of turn on more unhealthy genes that promote weight gain and promote diabetes and turn off the healthier genes with regard to that. So it sets you up to gain more weight and develop diabetes with these intrauterine events. So moving on to something that's trying to just touch briefly on some different stages of life. So in younger adults, that's one of the peak incidence times, or the peak times for autoimmune disease to develop. So things like lupus, rheumatoid arthritis. These diseases are very common in people in their teens and 20s in terms of the diagnosis. And what I'm showing with this slide is, and I'm sorry that the type is so small, but basically these are several different autoimmune diseases that are stacked here, and these on the left are the lupus and rheumatoid arthritis and those types. And you can see that as compared to the males, prevalence of these diseases, it's much more common in women. So that's really the gist of that slide. And at the Center for Women's Health Research, we're trying to help identify with some of our junior researchers why these autoantibodies that attack our tissues in women, why they develop, and then to be able to prevent those from happening. I'm just coming back to this again, which we already discussed, but as we get into middle age, cardiovascular disease becomes more common, diabetes becomes even more common, and we care about these diseases and improving health of women with regards to death from cardiovascular disease in middle age and older age. So I've hopefully walked you through this slide to understand that it's important to consider women's health across a lifespan and from several different facets, both biologic factors as well as perceptual factors. So here's where I said we'll make it personal. What can women's health do for you? So I've given you a taste of women's health today. You can go beyond your 101 level and get 201 level and beyond education about women's health issues. Our Center for Women's Health Research has online resources at our website, which you can Google University of Colorado Center for Women's Health Research, because it's very long as it goes across there. We have an annual luncheon where we bring in a speaker to talk about an interesting women's health topic each fall. And we always are inviting people for that. And there's also, this is a really neat resource, especially as I gave you some somewhat scary statistics about being a female patient maybe today, that you can read about how and why sex differences affect your health and the savvy woman patient, what you need to know. So this is produced by the Society for Women's Health Research, which is the flagship national organization to deal with women's health issues. So it's an excellent book, recommend it, and they also have a website with materials. And then what can you do for women's health? So you can share the information you learned today. We think peer education is very important too, so we want to educate the community and then have the community educate others. You can get involved in fundraising, community outreach for women's health research if this has really, really put a bug in your ear for how important this is. And we're always welcoming people to participate with us in that regard at our center. So, with that, I'm just leaving this slide up as something you can look at while I take questions. But we're ready for questions, and we do have a microphone, so we're going to ask you to take the mic.
Is this on?
Yes.
In the beginning, you mentioned that American women are 159% more likely to have a heart event than European women?
Correct.
Okay, so doesn't that indicate either a lifestyle or an environmental difference?
Great question.
Assuming women are the same all over the planet?
So it's a great question. So considering whether or not the racial ethnic minority mix, it would depend on the different nations that were involved there, because we know also our racial and ethnic minority populations in the United States have greater rates of cardiovascular events than do Caucasian individuals. But we certainly know that lifestyle plays a role in terms of heart disease, in terms of low physical activity is a major risk factor for cardiovascular events, diabetes or prediabetes, those things are also important. So healthy diet, absolutely a lifestyle role is important. So the question is their diet better than our diet if they're dying at, or if they're having lower events than ours? So that's a great question. I think it generates that hypothesis, really. Is diet the factor? And if we looked at people who had similar diets, if we could adjust for dietary factors, would we find that that answers all of it? Physical activity is also a very important lifestyle factor, and the Europeans' communities are generally more walkable than ours are also here in the United States. Hands over there. Microphone's coming.
Could you tell us what the scientists are, what they're researching, just to cover just a few of the topics they're looking at right now?
Absolutely. So, and that's part of why I left this slide up, was because these are some of our key areas. So we have scientists who are studying intrauterine growth restriction, which is when there's not enough nutrition to the fetus, and looking at what the, trying to test what the best nutrition would be then for those babies in early life, with the thought that certain ratios of fat to protein to carbohydrate might actually be helpful if they're utilizing their fuels, so to speak, if we think of diet as a fuel in a little bit of a different way than usual infants. So that's one area. There's definitely a lot of interest in the intrauterine environment. Another scientist is looking at neonatal stroke. So often we thought cerebral palsy was more of a developmental delay, but now we're learning much of it comes from neonatal strokes. Strokes actually while the woman's pregnant or in very early life. And so one scientist is looking at whether maternal infections or other inflammatory factors like diabetes or preeclampsia, how those might contribute to those events. And then I mentioned some about diabetes and cardiovascular disease. We're trying to understand why women with diabetes seem to have worse cardiovascular, have greater rates of death from cardiovascular disease than men with diabetes, and looking at various factors that could relate to that. That's a snapshot.
Hi, could you talk more about the why if your mom has diabetes, then you're at like a much greater risk to have diabetes?
Right, so the why of that is a question people are continuing to look into. It, as I stated, it's not that your genes are any different because you still got your genes from your mom and your dad, and there have even been studies looking at sibling pairs, so brothers and sisters who had the same parents, and then one had was born from a pregnancy with gestational diabetes and another was born from one without, and we definitely see these major differences. So it seems to be how your genes were turned on or turned off. So we all have genes and they handle all the different activities of our body, and they've just been changed in terms of how they're going to be expressed as life goes on based on things that occurred during the intrauterine environment. So there can be proteins that bind to promoter regions that then create the expression of certain genes, and others that turn off the expression of other genes. So I won't go further into epigenetics as it's dangerous for me, but I hope I gave a good overview. There's
Thank you. Can you please address hormones and heart health?
Sure. So addressing hormones and heart health, and I'm going to interpret that, and you can nod if I'm right, as estrogen and progesterone types of hormones and heart health for women. So I'm getting a nod, yes. And so the data from the Women's Health Initiative that came out several years ago now showed that women who were put on hormone replacement had greater rates of heart attack and stroke than the women who were randomized to not receive hormone replacement. And initially, after that study was published, it was a total shock to the medical system, because when I trained in medical school, that was what we were taught, is you need to put women on hormones. It's going to protect them from heart disease, because in all of the observational studies we had done, where we just looked at women who were either taking hormones or not taking hormones after menopause, the women on hormones seemed to do better. And it seems like what really we had there was a confounding, or women who were going to their doctors regularly and were seeing their doctors were also doing a lot of other proactive health activities. They were being very more healthy perhaps with their lifestyle. So we think that's why the observational studies that were earlier suggested it was beneficial, and then the randomized controlled trial, which is more rigorous, showed no benefit, in fact harm, from hormone replacement therapy. And a subsequent trial was done to ask, was it just the timing? If you give hormones to women right when they go into menopause, you sort of bridge that gap with no, you're not missing a beat. They didn't get a chance to sort of lose their female hormones and go menopausal, you just kept it going. Even in that study where they gave hormones to women very early in menopause, there was still harm. It still led to more cardiovascular events and not protection. Did I answer your question? You can ask me afterwards if there's more details.
Hi, some brain research says that caffeine and decaffeinated drinks can be helpful to the brain. But I'm wondering if you have any information on, there's some organic drinks like Giaca, which is like 25 or 50 milligrams of caffeine, and it gives you an energy boost. Is something like that considered dangerous for your heart?
So great question. I think if I could frame that broadly, if there's a fairly high dose of caffeine that you would get separate from just coffee, would that be potentially dangerous for your heart or not? And we're thinking it might be helpful for the brain, but we're making sure it's not harmful for the heart. That's the question. So it's a great question. In terms of the data that I'm aware of, I haven't seen anything published specifically on that supplement. And as you say, there's always studies about how chocolate in certain doses or coffee in certain doses that are relatively low, not, you know, multiple Starbucks per day, are good. So again, those are observational studies usually, and we just discussed some of the pitfalls of observational studies rather than randomized controlled trials. But I'm sorry that I don't know specific research to cite for you on whether that level of caffeine could be harmful or not. And we'll wait for just a moment for the microphone.
I don't think you answered the hormone question from the point of view you gave us history, but you didn't tell us what the current thinking is on hormone.
Okay, so I gave you history of doctors used to recommend estrogen and progesterone for women when they entered menopause, and then I presented data that it now appears harmful, at least in terms of certain outcomes. And I quote to my women all the time what the level of harm appears to be, which is about 1 in 2,000 increased events per year of heart attacks or stroke, and about 1 in 2,000 increased cases of breast cancer. So it's not, you know, people dying left and right. And there's still, where hormone replacement therapy is right now in the medical system is you shouldn't prescribe it for prevention, but it's still reasonable with a informed discussion with patients to prescribe it for quality of life menopausal symptoms. So if menopausal symptoms such as hot flashes are creating such difficulty sleeping that people are feeling very fatigued, feeling like they can't really function in their daily lives, and we've tried other medicines that are not hormones to treat that, such as very low dose antidepressants, which in that case wouldn't be used to treat depression, but are in fact being used to treat the hot flashes, then if we've failed those routes, then it's reasonable with informed consent from the patient to proceed with hormone replacement. We try to use then the lowest doses for the least amount of time possible and to wean them off as possible.
I have a real objection to the wholesale diagnosis of depression for women and just giving them something for depression. If you have a hot flash, you must be depressed. We'll give you antidepressants. What do you think of that?
Sure, so let me be careful too to say, as I just said, that the low dose antidepressants being used to treat hot flashes are not really used at therapeutic doses for depression, but they've just been shown to influence or lower the level of hot flash symptoms for women in, again, randomized controlled trials. So it's not putting women on an antidepressant and saying, you know, you must be depressed. So, but I think your question was broader than that. It seems like women are being just handed an antidepressant often, left and right, it seemingly. Maybe if they come in and say they're stressed or tired, they're ending up with a prescription for an antidepressant rather than working through whatever stress management techniques might be useful or some other approaches. And I think that's a valid concern. The use of antidepressants does continue to rise, and we do have standard criteria that have been put forth by psychiatrists with guidelines as to when we should you know, label something depression, but in clinical encounters, sometimes it's a little fast-paced for doctors to go through all of those specific criteria, and maybe we're just handing out prescriptions if people don't fully fit the diagnosis. So I take the concern that as a profession, we may be over-prescribing antidepressants.
Based on your study of exercise, what do you recommend as the best types and duration to lower heart disease risk?
Great question. So the U.S. Physical Activity Guidelines for Americans, which I was proud to be able to consult as part of, that were put out in 2008, found that the biggest bang for the buck for reducing heart disease came with getting 2.5 hours per week of moderate to vigorous physical activity, rather than amounts less than that for adults. Now, there was not a specific threshold that we found. In other words, benefits continued to seem to accrue with larger amounts of activity than that, but there was a distinct cut point where that amount was very helpful. We also found that smaller amounts were also useful, so really the guidelines as published are to move more and to encourage people to move, whether it's walking or biking or running, and to do activities that people are physically able to do that won't cause pain to arthritic joints for older adults or other issues. So people are able to do it and they enjoy it because you're more likely to stick with things that you enjoy. So 2.5 hours per week is the magic number that is quoted as an important amount, and more is better.
There's so much negative information now out talking about statins and how they're causing problems for people, brain health and all that kind of thing. Cholesterol, maybe higher cholesterol may not be as detrimental. Can you comment on that new information coming out?
Sure. I think that at least my interpretation of the studies, there's a wealth of data saying that statins reduce cardiovascular events for people with high cardiovascular disease risks. And so we've had 20 to 30 studies like that with different statins, different age groups. So we know that they're beneficial for reducing events in people who have moderate to high risk. However, I think what we've perhaps under-described or under-discussed, and maybe what's coming to the forefront now, is in most of those trials, there was what we'd call a run-in phase, where people would get, you know, some dose, and we'd make sure they were tolerant of it or didn't have serious side effects from it before they went forward in the study. And so then we'd end up studying people who were able to tolerate the medicine, and we saw benefits in those people. It's very common for people to get muscle aches with statins, and that can be quite detrimental, especially if it makes you not move. We just talked about how important moving is, and not to mention can cause pain and then cause people to take other medicines that can have side effects. So there are certainly side effects to statins. The one that's been probably fairly well debunked is the memory impairment with statins. So there have been some meta-analyses done that looked at, that actually pulled the original data from the trials and looked at the certain studies that had done assessments of cognitive function before and after treatment and ongoing, and those studies did not show worsening in the statin groups versus the placebos.
Could you tell us what the symptoms of a heart attack in females are?
Great. So a question, what would be the atypical presentation of heart disease in women as compared to men? So, and I won't say that men can't present this way either. So men won't always be typical either, and both men and women can have atypical symptoms. And I'll just give a brief background and then I promise to give you symptoms. And so there's visceral pain fibers that innervate the heart, and those same kinds of fibers innervate the abdomen and other areas in the chest. And they're just not as specific. So a nerve in your arm, if you cut your arm, your brain knows exactly what got cut. Whereas these visceral pain fibers that kind of are around a few different areas, if something gets affected by them, your brain's not quite so sure what's affected. The fibers cover a rather large space. So the with that said, the pain can be either pressure-like, which would be more classic, or it can be more of a burning pain. In fact, people sometimes feel like, will mistake a heart attack for heartburn, just feel like they're having some heartburn. Now, I don't want to scare you, because if you've had heartburn and you've had it periodically and you sort of know what meals trigger it, that's probably just heartburn for you. But this would be more like a burning pain that's not quite your usual, maybe not in the exact usual place for you and not particularly related to a usual food that would trigger that. So burning pain rather than pressure pain can be that, and it can be anywhere through the, you know, chest, from the middle of the sternum off to the left is classic, but it can also go across the chest. It can radiate up to the neck, over to the shoulder, or down the arm. And I mentioned that sometimes you'll just get those areas of radiation rather than either the chest, like my patient who had burning pain in her arm after square dancing, and that was her heart attack. So there's the variations of locations of the pain, the quality from burning to pressure. Associated symptoms can include shortness of breath, nausea, and sweating. And sometimes there's only a subset of those, not all of those. So I wish I could give you the exact way that women would present, but it's going to be some subset of those things often. Come up to the podium. Thank you.